Today's talk is given by Richard Tipper, Executive Chairman at Ecometric. His talk is entitled Climate Resilience Needs Geoscientists. Dr. Tipper is a champion of evidence-based environmental action and has worked as an advisor on climate change issues for many government, business and international organisations. Richard originally studied agricultural science here at Edinburgh and after some work in Mexico added an MSc in technology management. Then doctoral research on the economics of contemporary Mayan farmers. And following his PhD, he also obtained research funding to carry out work in Mexico, but also in India, Uganda, and Mozambique. So well travelled already. With growing commercial interest, Richard founded the Edinburgh Centre for Carbon Management, ECCM, and was later appointed to the UK roster of experts on climate change, was lead author of two IPCC reports. In 2007, in fact, his work in the IPCC was recognised as a contribution to the Nobel Peace Prize. So Richard also advised on numerous standards and methodologies for accounting for greenhouse gas emissions. And since co-founding Ecometric, where many of us know him from, also, Richard is focused on developing the Earth Observation and Spatial Data Platform side of the business, but he still acts as an advisor in many capacities to governments on climate issues. So basically that says everything. What better way to start our new season than tackling the biggest issues head on? That's why we're delighted indeed to welcome to the series Richard Tipper.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back. I think last time I was in this room, I don't think there was anything like the large number of people, so thanks very much for bringing everyone in despite the wet weather. As Owen mentioned, I was started in climate change before it became fashionable back in the early noughties, I think it was. It's interesting to see how sort of high profile and urgent the whole issue has become. Meanwhile, there's this been kind of slow drip, but also a gathering pace of the science, and it's interesting to see the kind of different types of dialogues going on between kind of the media, academia, business, and various pressure groups. And I think it's becoming a fascinating but obviously very challenging place for everybody. But I think the title of this talk, well, it's something I kind of probably thought up pretty much on the spur of the moment, but it seems in many ways just a kind of obvious statement, you know. Climate change, it is the biggest issue of the day, and probably not just of the day, but of several decades to come. And geoscience is really at the forefront of it. Geoscientists, climate scientists, and others who have done lots of background work and now are involved in so many ways. And I think there will be opportunities and requirements of you as geoscientists and different capacities address this in many different ways. It's one of those problems that got many different dimensions and could require many different specializations and types of people. But I thought what I'd do is take, because it's Friday afternoon, and I assume you didn't want to hear a lot about Ecometrica. If you want to hear about Ecometrica business planning work, you can find us on the website, and I'd recommend have a chat with Jess, who's got an internship with us, who knows a bit about the technology that we have and what that can do. Also Stuart Simmons, who is a point of contact often with the research collaborations that we have with Ecometrica. We run an annual internship for some of the students who are most interested to do that. Sometimes it's a competition to get onto that, but recommend you explore that. And we have as a business, we have several years of history now of collaboration with the university at various different levels. Professor Matt Williams' team, Jeremy Patton's team, and others. So, Professor Ian Woodhouse's group as well. I'll go through this, and it's meant to be relatively light-hearted, and hopefully we'll finish not too late, or certainly earlier, which will enable us to get off to the pub. far more important. So the start of this is, I thought, well, where to start? Friday afternoon, you don't want to get in too deep, about too technical or anything. What type of person are you? And I'm thinking, when I was talking to Owen, he's saying, well, it's got to be motivating students, young geoscientists as to where they're going to go, what kind of careers they might have in climate change or, you know, in geoscience. And I thought, well, the important thing, whenever I come across Edinburgh Geoscience alumni, they're all very good. They're much, I probably wouldn't get in these days if I was a student when I was back in the day. And they all come out with excellent skills, and I've hired probably about 20 or 30 alumni from this team over the years, and they've all worked out very well. They've all, if they're not still working with me, if they've gone on to other careers or back into research or off on to different things. So I think the issue isn't kind of what the opportunities out there, it's really what you want to do and how it will make your life fulfilling. So I've made this categorization of simple categorization of three types of people, and you might like it. It's just for you to kind of think about how you might fit into these things, or how these types of people reflect where you're going in your career, and just think about that. So the first category I've come up with is scientist. Now, you'll see next to the word scientist, there's an image of a kind of stereotypical boffin, mad boffin type. And you think, why did I choose this image? Well, throughout this presentation, I basically went onto Google, as one does, looking at images of the key words that you're looking at in the presentation. And what I sort of developed this little rule, I would pick the first image that came up of a long sort of cartoon image or a long graphic image, one which I think showed a human face. And it maybe give some indication, not so much of what I felt the image should be, but what Google came up with as society's stereotypical view of what this word is. So this is scientist, male, white, mad looking. Second type of person, the second category of candidate, the problem solver. Interesting that the person there is sort of, again, male, white, blurred into the background. I don't know quite what that image says, but again, it wasn't me, it was Google that came up with it. And the third type, entrepreneur, a bit more diversity there on the entrepreneur side. Again, it looks like the entrepreneur guy is male, but maybe a bit more diversity. Anyway, so these are the types that I thought of. What are the characteristics? And I thought, well, I'm thinking of people who are coming through in their careers, thinking about what they want to do, where should they sit best? And I think I could characterize people, scientists, I would say, are people who are wanting to understand a given problem. You know, climate change is a big problem. They want to understand it, they want to understand the mechanisms. How does it work? Why is it happening this way? Where are we, you know, what are the different parameters? What are the drivers? What are the impacts? So scientists are driven by this need to understand. Problem solvers, I would say, are people who are more driven to try to fix something. You know, they see the problem, they're immediately looking for solutions rather than details of that. Obviously you need to understand some of the causes, but if you're immediately starting to think of solutions, you're a problem solver. And this third category, I think they're people who want to turn problems into a business, like not just how can I solve the problem, but how can I create something that would create a living business that would address that problem or feed off that problem, not just as a one-off solution, but an ongoing thing. And so, you know, if the problem is climate change or if associated with agriculture, you might, as a business, want to develop a whole range of, sort of agricultural products or new varieties that could thrive in certain conditions. So and turn that into a business beyond just solving it once. And these types come through in many of the people that we see. So climate change is a massive problem, and as everyone knows, in terms of resilience, is this big challenge. The UN is currently estimating that addressing climate change, I mean, obviously there will be things that just can't deal with the impacts that will happen, but society is going to be spending $300 to $600 billion per year to deal with the impacts of climate change over the next decade, and that will double probably by 2050, and it may increase further. So how are these resources going to be used? Where do they need to be used? How do you measure the effectiveness of them being used? Again, all comes back to whether you're looking at this from the problem of a scientist as to trying to understand that, or trying to fix that and solve it, or trying to, you know, develop a business in that and work in it. Then I thought we'd unpack this a bit of this idea of resilience. The ability of a system to resist, cope with, or recover from given stress or disturbance. So there's a lot of talk about becoming resilient to climate change, but it's important to understand what does resilience mean, and how could we see it if we were working towards it? You know, when are we achieving it? So I thought we'd unpack some of the words, and this is what I came up with. This is the image that came up when I said resist climate change. This was the first image with a person's face on it. Resist, for those kind of people. What might we mean by resisting climate change? Well, these are what I think are sort of like a hard measures that you're actually protecting specific infrastructure or maintaining, if you like, the lines of current society against climate change, and you're not falling back, you're not having to move away or abandon certain areas. So I think one of the interesting things with how many areas that we currently regard as, you know, productive or urban or infrastructure will be maintained as they are, maybe strengthened to be resistant. And how many areas will we have to pull back from? How much should we resist? And how much should we pull back? Coping. This was the first image on... This was a strange image on coping. So a guy surrounded by people. Looks very staged, I think. So. Over like normal people somehow. So I think a lot. And the other question is, to some extent, climate change, people, societies, we just have to put up with stuff, you know. And how do we measure coping with climate change, the increased stress, changes to health in different areas. Changes to weather patterns. It may be that climate change happens, we just cope with it, just sort of get on with it. Maybe it affects, measures the quality of life, but in many cases things do change, and there is, we do have coping mechanisms. People talk about coping quite a lot in many other aspects. Resilience is recovery. Recovery is also an interesting thing. When a system has shocks to it, but is it able to recover, that is part of resilience. this is an interesting image on the cover of particularly biological systems are seen as having recovery potential, fire followed by regrowth. Economic systems have a recovery, usually after a big sort of disaster, there is a recovery effort. So geoscientists can be very much involved in different aspects of recovery. And so I think the questions that you might be involved in could be all these kinds of aspects of resilience, particularly recovery and resistance, where to resist, where to recover, where to just let things happen and allow people to cope with them. Then I was thinking, well, this is geography after all, let's try to frame the resilient system. When we talk about a system that needs to be resilient, what is the framing of that resilience? The system, exactly, the system boundaries. And I thought, well, let's go back to something simple. Let's think of a single area, like a farm. And when you think about a resilient system, obviously a system like a farm has its own milk capacity to different seasons, no 2 years are exactly the same, so it has a kind of inbuilt level of resilience to certain changes from the norm. But how resilient or capable that system is to change depends a lot on not just on the physical characteristics of the farm itself, the soil, the people, the genetics or the crops that have been grown there, but it also depends where you're looking at it from. So if you're looking at it from the farmer perspective, you're looking at it from your particular piece of land and how that is coping with the stress and how those changes will affect your income, your livelihoods, and your ability to continue as a farmer. If you look at it from the position of a buyer of products, you're maybe not just looking at a single farm, you're looking at a whole group of suppliers, and that single farm might be one of a row of different suppliers, and it doesn't affect you very much if one or two farms in your supply chain are not able to provide it. It only affects you if large numbers do. And if you're a buyer of multiple products, you may have flexibility as to where you buy things from. So I've spoken to buyers of supermarkets who would say, well, yes, okay, environmental information of individual farms isn't actually that useful to us. If there's a big scarcity in a region, we hear about that, and we just probably source from another area. So who needs to know what? And who's really framing that? If you're a government, for example, you might be very interested in farming systems within your specific areas of jurisdiction. So the areas that you're looking at, whether it's from a point of whether you need to intervene, whether you'll get tax revenues from the agricultural production, whether you'll get migration caused by people going out of business. And if you're a supplier of products, obviously you're kind of more aligned with the buyer. You're probably supplying seeds or agrochemicals or machinery to a wide range of farmers, and their needs might change over time as conditions change. So, framing of a system partly depends on sort of your perspective and who you are and where you are. I think there's also a geographic element as to at what level you're looking at. This is a kind of zoomed in area, just with some risk metrics for some kind of land use change risk map that we've used. But I've taken that area and I just zoomed out. So you zoom in and you're often looking at changes in a very specific area. When you zoom out, you're then looking at changes potentially over a bigger area. So what happens in one of those areas is only a small part of the picture. So others. Scale issues. And scale issues are one of the big questions that we deal with in terms of what's the most appropriate scale at which to try to measure change and monitor change. If you have a very high spatial density, it's often difficult to maintain a good quality of frequency of temporal resolution. So that's temporal resolution. Spatial resolution, there's often a bit of a trade-off. Then in terms of geosciences, I also wanted to feel, well, what are the sectors that you might be looking at resilience across? In Ecometrica, we're particularly interested in the following, and I think, you know, each one of these has a number of different dimensions. So agriculture, obviously, going to be highly affected by climate change. Production, where is it going to, how's it going to change in terms of the types of crops, the types of their location, what are the impacts of their moving will, perhaps the secondary effects might be things like that people might change their diets, so you have different balance of needs, you'll have different balances between, say, carbohydrate-based crops or protein-type outputs, will have potentially large changes in methods of production, moving towards sort of lower carbon intensity methods of production. Forests, another big area, looking at not just, well, there's both the direct human impacts with people moving as a result of agriculture or existing economic growth. There's obviously a lot of pressure on forests, and you see that with things like deforestation that's still, after, you know, even after decades of work, still seems to be on the rise again and a high component of overall emissions. If we want to get anywhere near the 1.5 or 2 degree limit on temperature rises, we're basically going to have to stop deforestation by 2030 and start reversing it and forest restoration overall. Okay, so where are those forests being restored? And is it really possible? How much forest can we retain? Other questions around forests relating to things like fires and diseases. So you see in many parts of the world greater incidence of certain types of forest fires. We're also seeing interactions between fires and pests where diseases have killed off certain types of trees, then they're much more prone to outbreaks of more intense forest fires. So that the need for looking at the resilience of forests will become ever greater. Coastlines, obviously, the one perhaps the most obvious candidate, with not you know, a combination of sea level rise but also human impacts, will obviously affect both human settlements and natural ecosystems around coastal areas. And how do we adapt to that? It's going to be a massive area, huge requirements for all sorts of skills. Freshwater resources, well, both freshwater for, you know, natural bodies of freshwater likely to be affected by climate change, both in their extent and the quality. Freshwater from the perspective of human usage, both that for agriculture and urban areas. Again, massive issue, particularly with things like temperature rises, increased evapotranspiration, but also in other areas, large increases in precipitation at certain types of years. So flood prevention and flood management. Urban expansion, urban management, huge. Again, other big areas around how do we adapt urban areas to deal with heat, potential dust or combining with other pollutants. And then the large scale infrastructure that's also sort of serving cities and trade routes, things like ports, pipelines, electricity grids, these kind of things are all vulnerable in different ways to certain aspects of climate change. So I think if you look at all those areas, you know, that there's vast potential for specialisation, or whether it's approaching it from a scientific point of view, a problem-solving point of view, or a business point of view. So really, just to finish off, what type of geoscientist are you? Are you driven by wanting to understand the problems, wanting to fix the problems, or generate businesses around the world? Those would be my thoughts. So that's my...
say scientists would probably make and sometimes work with us for a short while. So coming to a contribution, but scientists, if you're real, if you want to be a scientist, you should be working in a research facility. I think that's, you know, so we don't tend to, if we tend to not take people who we think are very much there to be motivated to understand the problem, because we want to either we either want the problem solver or the entrepreneur. So the problem solver will think of it, yes, because they won't necessarily exhaustively try to research the problem. We don't have time for that. No, a few businesses do, and if you want to do that, we should probably be aiming to have a research career. So we either want people who will do that, or be out for actually developing the business and even thinking perhaps beyond a specific problem, more to seeing how a business function can be created, which is probably, it can, for some people, they might have a sort of natural flair for that, but some people, they develop that over time, having solved lots of problems. I think, perhaps in my case, I started as a problem solver, and then I kind of thought, well, I've just done this so many times, I thought I want to try to get it sort of more systematic and get a lot of people to do that, and I'm into management.
Right.
there seems to be vast amounts of data. Whenever you look at a specific area and you have a specific problem to address, there never seems to be exactly the kind of data or the right data that you need. Therefore, you have to pace around and get more data. And it is one of those things, I don't really have an answer to it, but it definitely, I mean, there is a lot more, and I think now there is also better understanding of what's needed and useful at national level for big picture things. So even when we started Econometrics 10 years ago, there was, and you're looking at understanding how land use change is happening, let's say national scales or regional scales, national scales, there was quite a basic understanding we had land sampling. You know, a lot has happened. In 10 years we've got the sentinels and they're starting to put a lot of detail in, and countries, even you know, the more developing countries, are now developing quite sophisticated systems based on sentinel, sort of combinations of sentinel and LandSat to look at land use change systematically over, you know, 2-3 year periods, and they are making use of that. Lots of this other very high detailed stuff will scatter sits, but I think there's a big difference between global systematic data sets, which are very, you know, you can produce these large composite products from one thing, and then from the science community, you tend to have lots of scattered little bits of data from regions, or not actually, sometimes it's big data, but it's little in terms of it can't be, it's not got continuity necessarily, it's not got the coverage, it's not got the systematic comparability that you can often use it for the problem you want. Maybe it was useful for a specific study, but when it was collected for. But often, and that's again one of the sort of differences I say between the science and the problem solver and the business. If you take it as a business perspective, we're always looking at things that will be long term, large coverage. You don't have to then go and, you know, go and do a separate sort of study each time you want to solve the problem. You want to have sets of data that can be applied to several different problems, ideally. And I think this is the problem, is there's so much piecemeal stuff done around the world, and a lot of that data will just be light little photos that you took 10 years ago, and sort of stuck down there in the cloud somewhere across the world.
There's a couple here.
What would you say the most impactful things you want to do is to tackle climate change?
The most impactful thing?
Yeah, just in everyday life.
I mean, honestly, I don't know. I think those are it's a difficult question because, you know, what you could try to live a low emission life, or you can try to, and these things aren't really exclusive, you can try to be part of a innovation to develop new technologies. I mean, I'm probably the kind of person I'm not the most environmentally conscious person when it comes to my own personal lifestyle, let's say. You know, I'm practically vegetarian, but I do quite like vegetarianism. From work, I travel a lot by air. I find it wasting, but it's probably just because I'm a bit mean. And I don't like shopping, so I don't use, you know, my clothes carbon footprint is pretty low. And I would say to my daughters, I have very low hairless carbon footprint. Whereas I would say, you know, they use lots of hair products. And they might be vegan, but they're pretty expensive. Palm oil based hair products. So, I think that the solutions, I don't think it's likely that humans will go back to a life of sort of frugality on a large scale. I think people, it's very difficult for a new generation to come in and say, well, look, we're all now going to give up lots of things that the previous generation had taken for granted. And there's something, why should they? I mean, when I got to the age of 17, I think I'd taken one flight by the time I was 17. Now I take several flights on a month or whatever. But, you know, and I think, are we really going to go back to the sort of 1970s? Maybe people will want Brexit. My blood takes back the 1970s.
So I don't really have good answers to what individuals can do. I would say if you can put a technology that will save, or a kind of a process, you could probably have a much bigger impact than just your reflection. But I know that's not a very good answer. Really. Yeah.
You mentioned obviously you had three options: scientist, problem solver, entrepreneur. Entrepreneur wouldn't have been something I would have seen logically coming out there personally. So where do you see business in the context of climate change and its contribution to
yes. So I think that's it's interesting because I think, and I've seen this in that working with scientists. When I was part of the IPCC, and I was saying, well, actually, I've got some businesses interested, I'm talking to colleagues, scientific colleagues. So actually, they're getting approached by quite a lot of businesses who want advice on this business. They just want to make money out of it. But actually, I think if you think about it, if business exists, it has to adapt, it has to change, it has to do things. Business can't not exist. Everyone's got to have, people have to have jobs, I suppose. I mean, not everybody can be working in an NGO or in the government sector or in whatever. So mainstream business that provides all the services has to be involved. And I think if you want to influence those, having worked with business, businesses work with businesses. If you want to change business, you work with another business to help that business. Rather than, everything has its place. So NGOs are often good at pressurising businesses, but if they actually want to implement something, they will go to another business for a solution. So if you can be part of that solution, then that's a business opportunity.
So do you think business will innovate new ways to tackle climate change, or it will adapt to climate change?
Well, both. So at the very simplest level, businesses are already to some extent adapting to climate change. So some of those adaptations might be negative. So they might be, for example, in heat waves, they're installing more air conditioning. So which obviously has additional energy requirements. But there may be other businesses, already agribusiness is adapting. So we did some work a few years ago for a large brewing company that has assets that they brew beer in Africa using barley grown on the highlands in Kenya. This well-known Kenyan beer, they're finding that the sources of nationally produced barley are more difficult because the barley, which requires a low temperature maturation, is off that low temperature is often exceeded. So they're looking at, they're already adapting by looking at other types of crops that use like cassava for beer production, or kinds of adaptations then you can turn it to the way they source barley and what kind of contracts they have with the farmers. So businesses are already adapting just in a kind of mainstream way. But I think the businesses that will survive and come forward in the next 20 years will be the ones that have that right, good strategy for combining producing low carbon business models with climate change resilience. Business is not adapted to climate change, it will suffer.
Thanks, Richard, for a very interesting talk. I'm just interested in where technology fits in, particularly into your business. I know quite rightly you haven't got technically, it's one of your classifications. Do you see your technology sort of underlying importance, or is it too here today, gone tomorrow?
Technology is constantly evolving. The technology that we use is constantly evolving, and the solutions, obviously, we develop on the base technologies that are there. So, for example, cloud computing is something. We are not the prime developers of cloud. Cloud computing is developing, and we make use of that as it evolves. Systems. The same with all of the Earth observation sensors. We are end users of technology, and we want to be among the first to apply the new technologies for our own. own purposes, you know, so thinking of it as a business is that if we you know, we need as a business to adopt, if we don't adopt the technology, we will fall behind and somebody else will take our place and provide a better quality of service. That's the sort of entrepreneurial approach. So I think we develop some technology, you know, but the technologies we develop are on top. It's like a thin layer on top of the broad technology that's being developed. So when we started the business, cloud computing for Amazon Web Services was pretty primitive. We had most of our systems running on hard drives for the first few years. It was only once AWS got its different sorts of services up and running that you could call on, you could spin up, you could reduce down. We moved stuff over onto that. Same with our earlier engagements with business, we were project by project using a scene of Landsat. You know, we'd say, we get this scene of Landsat, we get that scene of Landsat, we do some processing. Nowadays, you know, there's a sort of stream of processing that goes all the way through straight from central hub or wherever it is, one of these GPS centers. And there's a number of steps in processing, and that's all done in the cloud, and then you sort of shut down the servers after it's done, and you kind of, so that is using the technology. There's an ecosystem of technology. It's different people producing different things, and I think with a business, you're part of that network, and you're saying, right, who's developing that bit for that? And you're constantly, you're not trying to develop everything yourself, and that's another important about business, I'd say, as opposed to say, perhaps if you're just a problem solver, you just see a problem you want to solve yourself. But often with a business, you say, actually, these guys over there, they got really good resources, or they're solving that in a very perfect way. Well, let's not use our resources to do that. Let's just buy that off them, and let's take it off there, and let's put that together, and we'll do this bit in the middle here, or something like that. So it's picking what you do and what you take off. And that's one of the interesting things, I think, around things like these open source development projects and things like that is now understanding which bits of code you can use. Not everything just because it's open source is great. I mean, that's the other thing. I would say open source on its own kind of tools, you have to be discriminating against which bits you should bring into your technology stack. We talk about the technology stack and we talk about the technology roadmap. And this is very much trying to understand what it is that your customers will want, how the technology is evolving, which things we should bring in, which things we prioritise. So we have a process agile development where we every 2 weeks update our system with a new version, some new things being added onto it. And that what gets added on each time, each iteration, has been through a sort of pipeline of consideration of whether it's priority, whether it's technically feasible, whether it can be done better by something else, and whether what we'll be doing. Once we even bought the technology from the university, it's technology.
You maybe answered my follow-up question, which was how you keep up with that. Tying things together and building that veneer around these technologies.
A lot has to be done to ensure that doesn't become unmanageable spaghetti. So you go through periods where you actually say, actually, no new features for the next 3 months. We're just going to untangle some of the, it's called technical debt, is the term that we use. And we say, actually, we're just going to try and simplify and take out some of the old bits that are kind of redundant or something down there. And we're trying to simplify. And you realize that this bit we've built here actually isn't being used very much, so let's get rid of that and just put something else. So that's always going on. And I think that's, for me, that's what the sort of living, breathing business is. It's looking at all those things, not just trying to, this is the problem, that's trying to solve it.
I must remember that phrase, I had a controversial thought, you need more can-do technologists, so if you need as many can-do that and full life self-managing self-management.
Yeah, it's going the right balance, I think. Absolutely. So we have,
I think what you've really helped us to do now is kind of deconstruct and blur those boundaries a bit.
Yeah.
Metric is an example of that. It's kind of, you come from universities and understanding of how they operate. Mm. If you really explain well how you operationalize things, we know that the kind of stereotypical academic, we research something, we write one paper, and then we stop. Mm. Really, that's the point at which businesses take over. Mm. You know, we often need continuity to think about how we could operationalize something, and yours write that class paragraph on the research paper.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if
The last month of the project or whatever. By the way, you might do something.
Think about how this carries on at the end of the research project, yeah, which is kind of like the classic of the researchers now. I just wanted that there's this kind of circle here, you can see examples where I think sometimes the sense that it's just implement things, it's kind of underselling it a bit, because I'm sure there must be lots of examples where in the process of operationalizing it, streamlining it, and solving or adapting it, you take an idea and then you realize actually in the process of really making that operationally work, it throws up another series of challenges. Actually, you're all finding those challenges.
Yes, there's a few good examples of that. I mean, one of them, current one, is a problem that we have around automatically detecting vegetation change using Sensible One SR data and time series. And we have a kind of a maths vehicle, so it's a digital hub. Somebody helps a hub. So the, Data Lab is an innovation center here at the Bates Center, and they've finished a couple of years. The costs of this very good. We have these looking at helping with some of the maths behind making this process of identifying when a change is a real change or a certain type of change, and being able to make that smooth and efficient. There's a lot of potential complexity behind that. Yes, we come up, I suppose often it's perhaps more the case that we're developing something, we come up with a barrier that's more than what we thought it was. So problem is when we first close it, I think it's right, actually, it's more difficult than we need to have. So that's often the case. And so those are the things that we come up with.
I was wondering to what extent your company has a metric kind of for the climate impacts of your clients. I would just, you're helping them to adapt to climate change, but that's not necessarily mitigation, it could be exploitation, to help them to exploit any areas of their business.
Yes, so, well, one of the big products we provide our clients is greenhouse gas accounting. So we can play a count of their greenhouse gas emissions and using different standards. And one of the interesting things about that is while we, the way greenhouse gas accounting works, it is similar perhaps in financial accounting, but it doesn't always, it's difficult to account for, let's say, things that are outside the company boundary. So what happens with the company's products or what happens up the supply chain. I think that's just one of the challenges that we've done various amount of studies that just not something we do particularly because it's so bespoke. But I think in terms of it's part of our bread and butter is how the companies report in a way that they get back to the function. Doesn't mean it couldn't be done a lot better. But if somebody could come up with a business that could do the challenging thing of these more kind of complex causal greenhouse gas analysis where we find changing something in my design of my products or I'm changing my supply chain, what are the impacts back on climate change, not just within my business boundaries but broadly. That would be very interesting. We've seen there are certain types of things, you know, so we're very good at productizing corporate greenhouse gas account, but we've not been able to productize this kind of life cycle that if you want to talk about that, I would recommend you talk to Matthew Brander, who's one of our he's our lecturer. We have a
scouting
here.
So that can do it this weekend.
Yeah, okay, thanks. So there was a question about whether businesses adapt to climate change or whether they address climate change. And I think I would argue that businesses are actually a fundamental part of the solution to address climate change, because we are actually time-starved. The crisis is real, and the time is the clock is ticking, really. But because of the market and the competition that the market actually triggers, businesses are best placed to actually innovate and create innovations. And we've seen that with Tesla, we've seen that with wind farms, solar cells, and energy storage. So there's a huge amount of businesses that actually create solutions that are extremely innovative and really good. And then that brings the idea that you know, there are businesses and then the government and academic, but we all those different roles have a place to play, and it's about the collaboration with them. So subsidies, governmental subsidies can support a huge amount of innovation in businesses and so on. So I think we have to be very careful about create divisions, where I think as a society we really have to make a concerted effort.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult, and I think that not good justifications for strong criticism,
yes.
where that's due as well. And I think there's the role that Ecometrica takes is we try to, and there are plenty of people who are out there, if you like, putting pressure on different sectors, and particularly the NGOs and so on. We've taken the position as a business to try to not give opinions as to what's good or what's bad, just to measure things. So we're very much a measurement business, and we just say, well, that's the number, you know, but you then interpret it and say whether it's good or what you should do about the number. But we're very much a kind of neutral numbers business. That's just the nature of what we do, and we decided that that is to be acceptable to a wide range of customers. That's the best position to take, so that our numbers are seen as credible and our processes are seen as credible. We're not seen as somebody who's then going to come and, you know, bash you over the head or do a big expose about your business because we've come up with these numbers for you. So there are others, like more from the NGO side. I mean, I think there's an interesting interplay at the moment between us, ourselves, and World Resources Institute. You've probably heard of Global Forest Watch, many of you, which is an initiative by the World Resources Institute to measure deforestation around the world. And the interesting thing is that their approach has been to do it using NASA data and Google and guys, and they produce numbers for deforestation for all the countries, and they publish them and they tell the world what they think deforestation has been. Whereas our approach has been to work with the countries to develop national systems so that they can work out what they think their deforestation is. Because our view is that a lot of countries won't accept the fact that just being told by some North American NGO what the numbers are. Because often we come up with many cases where the numbers are not right. So I think trying to help develop capacity in countries and places where that capacity doesn't exist is another big opportunity.
Right,
sorry,
my mind wanders on to United Central Planning and Free Market Capitalism. okay, I was going to just go for it and then we'll just get to the rest.
Yes.
Yes, quick question. This is our government and your site to use some of this software. I mean, that you do the metric and your site to use.
Yes, lots of our. Software developers who are able to do that, that's the main software team, software open source.
passively, while there's a project going on, they have a software developer working on it. But then when a project ends and that software developer goes off and gets a job somewhere else or leaves them, then everything falls apart and they then lose all the progress. I mean, we've seen this in, you know, just like it's become possible to find.
Thank you very much for...